408-2438, Voigt and Alexander versus the Teamsters. Mr. Schoenberg?
Yes.
May it please the court and counsel. I'm here representing Daniel Voigt and Dan Alexander in claims against the Teamsters Union, Local 662, Joint Council 39, and various officers of those two entities. Mr. Alexander and Mr. Voigt allege violations of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. Now, that act was passed by Congress because of its concerns about union corruption and fraud and abuse of power, allowing union hierarchy to stay in power for long periods of time. The main purpose of the act was to ensure that unions operate in a democratic fashion. I believe the facts of this case show that union democracy was destroyed and diminished, not furthered, by what occurred to my clients. The facts of this case are voluminous. You've read the briefs, I'm sure. But they all boil down to one main issue. Either it's acceptable to threaten, harass, and intimidate, and lie to union members, or it isn't. It's that simple. My clients believe that that was not appropriate conduct, and they took action to right those wrongs. And because of the action they took, adverse actions were taken against them.
For those adverse actions, how did it affect their membership?
Well, as to Voigt specifically, Judge, Voigt, the district court has already found that Local 662 violated his membership rights when they removed him.
And okay. $9,000.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that, because I think that is the crux of Voigt's appointed employment claim. There is direct evidence in this case from Mr. Reardon himself that he removed Dan Voigt from his appointed position because of views and opinions he expressed as an elected officer. There's also evidence that he was fired from his appointed employment position because he filed charges against David Reardon and two other officers regarding impropriety. In this union, you can only be an elected officer as a member. So when you speak as an elected officer, you're representing the entire membership in your views and opinions, but you're also representing yourself in your views and opinions. As to filing charges, you can only file charges as a member of the union. I can't charge Dave Reardon. You have to be a member. So when he's bringing charges forward related to impropriety, he's doing that as a member. When David Reardon fired Dan Voigt because of the views and opinions he expressed as an elected officer, he sent a message to three separate groups. He certainly sent a message to Dan Voigt. He was still an elected officer at that time, that, you know, if you're going to disagree with me on policy issues, bad things are going to happen to you. Okay? Same with filing charges. Make Dan Voigt think, well, now, wait a minute. I know that there's impropriety going on here, but do I dare bring it forward? Well, not if adverse actions are going to be taken against me.
I guess my question wasn't a very good one, but I'm interested in what effect it has on your union membership, anything that happened here.
Well,
I mean, these guys all,
sure.
I don't know, they came up in, through the ranks, I assume, through union politics, and now they're on the board and they're appointed to various, like the business agent apparently is a paid union position.
Right. And let me, and I think I know where you're heading, Judge, and as far as him still being a member, well, no, of course it didn't affect that. He could still be a member. But how he acted as a member, I think it did have an effect on that, or it presumably would have an effect, because you're going to second guess yourself as to whether you, how you speak as an elected officer, or whether you bring impropriety to light as a member. So I think that's really the effect. Certainly he still had full membership rights, but I'm not sure that that's the relevant inquiry. I think it is, what effect does it have on exercising your membership rights? It's that very effect that determines, are we going to operate in a democratic fashion or aren't we? And I want to go back to that point that I was making, because I mentioned the three groups. Other officers sitting on this board would certainly say, well, wait a minute. I know why Dan Voigt was fired. Am I going to disagree with David Reardon on a policy issue if he can take my livelihood away? Nope. Yep. David, whatever you say, that's good. Good with me. That's what we'll do. How does that further the interest of the members? The members have elected these people to represent their interest. If David Reardon has a improper or a poor policy that he wants to further, is another officer going to stand up and say, well, no, wait a minute, we ought not do that? Well, not if he's going to get fired, not if he's going to get his employment taken away. And the same with filing charges. If another officer discovers that David Reardon engages in impropriety, do you think that officer would come forward and say, I need to file some charges against Dave Reardon because of this? He's not going to do that if he's going to get fired from his appointed position. That's where he earns his income from. As to the membership as a whole, the membership is very intuitive to these things. They knew what was happening. They saw Newell get removed from his position. As soon as Newell was removed, Vogt was terminated as a business agent. The members are also saying, well, wait a minute. I got to be careful if I want to come forward and talk about impropriety, or if I'm going to voice any concerns about things before the executive board, because maybe I'll lose my employment, my livelihood. So does it affect them as a member? No, they were still at that point card-carrying members. But does it affect how they act? Absolutely.
Well, how do they go about removing a business agent that they have policy disagreements with?
Well, I think that's the... I don't have a problem, and I don't think the Supreme Court would have a problem with removing a business agent for a policy disagreement. I think the Supreme Court would have a huge problem with removing an elected official because he had a policy disagreement, removing an elected official from his employment post because of a policy disagreement with another union officer. I think that's the disparity here. If I'm just an appointed agent appointed by David Reardon, I've been appointed to further his policy and agenda. Okay? I can understand that. That makes sense. That's the Finnegan holding, and that furthers the democratic function of the union. However, when I have more than just that single status, when I'm also an elected official, and actions are being taken because of how I act in that capacity, removing my employment status, that's a different ballgame and violates the act.
Haven't you just undercut Alexander's case by your argument?
No. Thanks for that question, Judge. I have not. Let me tell you why. Alexander, every action taken against Alexander, I agree, was related to his employment. However, that ignores the monster elephant in the room, and that is he was only exercising his rights as a member. That resulted in those adverse actions. There's two things that he wanted to do. He wanted to testify in front of a union tribunal. That is a right guaranteed only to members, not employees, guaranteed to him by the IBT Constitution. Because he wanted to testify, David Reardon made threats regarding his employment status.
Was that testifying on behalf of what?
No, testifying in front of, on behalf of one of the charges filed related to Russell and impropriety that he engaged in.
Alexander was defending Vogt, wasn't he? Isn't that part of the problem?
That's exactly the second point. There's two points. One, he wanted to testify at the first hearing before Vogt had any issues. Okay? That was the hearing in front of joint counsel related to Newell and Russell's charges. The second membership right he was attempting to exercise is once adverse action was taken against Vogt, he wanted to represent Vogt in those union hearings. That is a right also only guaranteed to members and guaranteed by the IBT Constitution. So it's those two membership rights that he was attempting to exercise that resulted in the pattern of threats, intimidation, and harassment against him. So Alexander is a little different animal from Vogt's claim because he was clearly representing only rights guaranteed to him by the IBT Constitution, and because of the exercise of those rights, threats were undertaken against him. And my point would be, what better way, if you are the union hierarchy, than to attempt to get people to stop members, to stop exercising their membership rights, than to threaten to take their livelihood away? What better way to do that? I mean, if you come to me and say, if you want to represent Vogt, I'm going to fire you, and that's my right as a member to do that, that's a huge problem. That's a huge problem. It's a problem under the Act, and I think the Supreme Court would have a problem that under Finnegan or Lynn. So I think that's where that stands. But I'm glad you brought those two questions up, because I think those are really the crux of both votes, loss of appointed claim, appointed employment claim, and Alexander's claim related to what happened to him.
Does the record tell us why Newell is no longer in this case?
Well, I'm sure, Judge, that that will be an issue that's hotly contested if this gets remanded back for a trial. From our perspective, the record is quite clear, and it's in my brief. I think I set forth all the facts about how Newell had discussions with Russell that you cannot tell these members that a standalone security health plan is a Teamsters health and welfare plan. Russell's response to that was, well, I know that, but they don't. And that's really what started all the balls rolling down the hill here. That was unacceptable to Jim Newell. It was unacceptable to Jim Newell, and he fired him, fired Russell, because of that. Apparently, that wasn't unacceptable to some other officers of the union, and they reinstated Mr. Russell. I asked Rick Skutek under oath at a deposition about that lie, and I said, well, weren't you concerned about that? And he said, well, what was the danger in that? We were going to lose the group. So apparently, anything goes. It doesn't matter. Tell the members whatever you need to tell them. Just make sure they don't leave the Teamsters Union. And I just don't think that's acceptable. I know Newell didn't think it was acceptable. He took action because of it. Russell filed charges against Newell because of the action that he took, and joint counsel expelled Newell from office and membership. And then that's when she really started to roll downhill.
You know, I heard that question to be a little different one, and that is, what I'm interested in is, why isn't Newell in this case? In this case?
Yeah, for a myriad of reasons, Judge.
Does the record tell us?
No. If you want me to make representations, I will, but the record's not going to give any indication as to why.
The question was, does the record tell us why Newell is no longer here? And it doesn't, apparently.
I would like to go back to Alexander. He was, after representing Vogt, well, is it Vogt?
It's Vogt.
He was terminated by Reardon?
Well, he actually wasn't terminated. There was, August, September, October, November, about 6 months, 5-6 months of harassment and threats from Reardon, and then Fred Jaguar.
You resigned.
Yeah, and because of that, he just said, you know what, I've had enough of this. This isn't a Democratic union. I'm out.
And he got a little severance package, too, didn't he?
I don't remember the financial terms. There was a severance agreement that was signed, but it was not a release. It's not the typical severance. That's a release of all claims severance, so that's not an issue here. It was.
Right.
I don't know if there was, like, 3 weeks of pay or whatever. I don't remember what it looked like.
Well, one issue is exhaustion of administrative remedies, and then that's with regard to Alexander.
Yes.
Would Reardon have been the person that would have heard that on 662?
Yes, Judge, and that's precisely one of my main concerns with the district court's ruling. Now, it's an abuse of discretion standard for the exhaustion issue. I acknowledge that. But I got a huge problem with the decision for these reasons. I believe it's Dubitz, D-U-B-I-C-Z, versus Commonwealth Edison, which is a Seventh Circuit case, which says it is an error to rely on an erroneous factual or non-existent factual record in making a decision. And that's exactly what happened here. The judge speculated that, well, maybe Reardon could recuse himself from hearing Alexander's charges, and then, well, maybe Fred Jaguar, the head of joint counsel, who also made threats to Mr. Alexander, can recuse himself. And then, well, if that didn't happen, maybe the IBT could accept the case, the International Union could accept the case and hear it. There's a problem there. It ignored the very facts that the district court judge found violated the LMRDA as it related to Dan Vogt. Dan Vogt was screaming, saying, hey, wait a minute, Dave Reardon, you can't sit on my disciplinary panel. Dave Reardon didn't care. He sat on the panel. He sat in judgment of Dan Vogt. Not only that, the evidence, and there's testimony from one of the panel members that when he was called out of the blue, he showed up and he was told what the outcome was supposed to be before there was any evidence.
So your position, I guess, is that it would have been futile to argue before Reardon, since he was instrumental in whatever you want to call the severance or something.
Yeah. No question about that, Judge. No question. He didn't recuse himself on votes panel. Why would we think that he'd recuse himself on Alexander's panel? So that to me is futile. As to Jigaris, again, it's just pure speculation. There's no evidence in the record that Jigaris ever recused himself from any matter. So there's no evidence to say that he would in this case. My real trouble is with the IME.
Exhaustion is futile here. Then you still have the possibility of losing on the merits. I mean, the magistrate knocked it out on failure to exhaust.
Right.
Alexander. But we're going to look at the whole case here. But
that's why I just want to emphasize, Judge, that what happened to Alexander was purely and only because he was exercising rights guaranteed to him by the IBT Constitution as the member of the union. He was exercising the right to speak at a union tribunal hearing, number one, and threats were communicated to him about that. And then two, he wanted to represent Vogt after adverse actions were taken against Vogt, which is also a right only guaranteed to members of the union. Because of the exercise of those membership rights, the pattern of threats, harassment, and intimidation were undertaken against him. So certainly, I believe, without question, that exhaustion was futile in this case, number one. And number two, that the court based its decision on a record that didn't exist. Three, it's clear to me that Finnegan does not bar Alexander's claims because he was exercising those membership rights. So I think that's the important distinction. So I believe that he does have a meritorious claim under Section 101A2, Section 609, and also a separate and distinct claim for the suppression of dissent within the union. Now, I know the circuit has never spoken on that issue, but it seems to me that if you take Jim Newell out of his position because of acts he thought were improper, then you set your sights on Dan Vogt because he filed charges and you remove him from office, membership, and employment. Then you set your sights on Dan Alexander and threaten, harass, and intimidate him. And two people who appeared at the tribunal in front of joint counsel also had sights set on them, Karen Hazy and Tim Hazy. Karen Hazy was a clerical staff in the Stevens Point office where David Reardon resided. Tim Hazy was a member of the union. They testified in front of joint counsel on behalf of Jim Newell and Dan Vogt in the charges they filed. After they testified, Rick Skutek told them they needed to write a letter of apology to the executive board for the testimony that they gave.
All your rebuttal time here, so if you want a little bit, a couple minutes, you better...
Let me just make one point about the damage issues, Rule 15 and Rule 54. My major concern with those rulings, is that the district court was holding the plaintiffs to a standard that no other litigant has ever been held to, and that is if you don't have everything in the original pleading, no matter how far the trial is down the road, regardless of the fact of whether discovery had even started, regardless of whether you've even disclosed your Rule 26 disclosures yet, it doesn't matter. You're bound by the context of the original complaint. I don't believe that that's the Seventh Circuit policy on Rule 54, and I certainly don't believe that it supports the liberal construing of Rule 15. Thank you.
Mr. Soldan?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Scott Soldan and Nathan Eisenberg, who's here with me, represent the defendants in this case. Let me begin, if I may, by addressing the notion that somehow this case differs from Finnegan as well as this Court's decisions in Hodge and Brunt. It doesn't. In Finnegan, we had a situation in which a local union officer wins an election, decides that he wants to have staff loyal to him, and because those 15 business agents supported his opponent in the election, he discharges them. The United States Supreme Court says that is not actionable. It's not actionable because it did not affect their union membership, merely their employment. In the Hodge case, which we litigated in this court nearly 25 years ago now, this court sustained the discharge of a union employee because she had decided to support an opponent in a union election. Relying specifically on Finnegan, the court finds that the new administration is entitled to exercise political rights and to determine whether or not to keep people in its employment. And finally, very recently, in Brunt versus Service Employees, which is also cited in our brief, union members of the Service Employees Union in Milwaukee decided that they would not support the reelection campaign of the union president. The union president told them flatly, "You will support my election campaign or you will lose your employment." They refused to support his election campaign. He discharged them from employment. This court held no violation of the law. That is the law. It cannot be quibbled with. It cannot be distorted so easily as counsel would have you believe. The point of this is that people may be discharged because they do not support an incumbent union officer. That is a political right which Landrum Griffin has granted since 1959, in which the Supreme Court and this court have approved over 30 years of decisions. There's nothing different about this case. It's a routine application of Finnegan, Hodge, and Brunt.
I should talk just a minute about the exhaustion and Alexander. I sort of think that's a difficult issue. And you want to talk about it, how you'd approach the merits then if we found that exhaustion should not have been required here.
On his failure to exhaust the internal union remedy?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be happy to address that. First of all, Mr. Alexander was not disciplined by the union. He was not discharged by the union. Nobody in the union, neither Mr. Reardon nor anybody else at either the local union or the joint council level, took any action against Mr. Alexander. Mr. Alexander, who worked as an appointed business agent for the union, on the day that he decided to quit his employment, which is what he did, left the union office, went to a law firm where his wife works, talked to her about it, went and talked to Mr. Vogt, plaintiff here, went and talked to Mr. Newell, another plaintiff here, went and talked to other people and made up his own mind that he was going to quit. He then came back to the union office, broached the subject with Mr. Reardon, and negotiated a separation agreement. That separation agreement is page 103 of the supplemental appendix. In that separation agreement, he gave a two-week notice. He was allowed to take his bank vacation time. He was allowed to collect his unemployment comp, even though he quit, which you don't get in Wisconsin if you quit. He agreed that it was a voluntary settlement. He received his severance pay package, which he was not entitled to because he didn't give the right notice, but the union gave him that. He signed it that day with Mr. Reardon. He left. He got every one of those benefits, every one of them. And we heard nothing further from him until this lawsuit came in. He never gave the union any opportunity to act. He never filed an internal union charge about the allegations in this complaint, about the allegations counsel makes today, about anything that happened to him. But he took the benefits of the separation agreement and put them in his pocket.
I'm clarifying. Now, if he took the unemployment benefits, would that have to be an agreement to be terminated?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To get the unemployment benefits, you have to be terminated.
To get the unemployment benefit, you would have to leave. Normally in Wisconsin.
No, I mean leave. I mean, you can't quit and get them, can you?
That's right. You cannot.
So I'm trying to focus on, wouldn't that have to be an agreement to be terminated, what you just described?
Yes. Yes. He agreed that he would leave, and the union
agreed that he'd be terminated.
And he agreed that he would leave, and the union agreed not to contest his unemployment comp. But that was his decision, Your Honor, and the document itself says.
I just want to clarify that, because that, I don't think you'd want to say that you made some kind of a deal that he was going to get him anyway when he shouldn't have.
I know his counsel thinks now that he can sort of twist this into some kind of something other than what it is, which is a voluntary resignation of his employment, Your Honor. That's what it is. To return to your question, Judge Evans, if I may, this court has also dealt with Teamster constitutional remedies and internal union exhaustion. In Tinsley versus UPS, which is cited in our brief, this court goes through in detail, what the law requires and what members of the Teamsters Union have to do. Members of the Teamsters Union, as with almost every union in this country, have got to file internal union charges if they think something bad has happened to them by union action. In Tinsley, this court found that the Teamster remedies are mandatory, that they are adequate, and that they must be exhausted. Now, as to the newly found question of futility, the cases cited in our brief, I think, are quite clear on this point. At no time may a member simply decide not to even try to exhaust the remedy. The member is not entitled to do that. The member must do what the Constitution says, which is to file a charge and let the union attempt to act.
In all these exhaustion cases, though, we ordinarily try to look at a situation and say, well, pretty obvious that the deck was stacked against you and you don't have to exhaust. Like in a prison context where guards that are involved in the case are going to be the people who are going to hear your grievance or something, we often excuse exhaustion in that situation.
Judge, I would say to you, I'm certainly not an expert on prisoner cases by any means.
That's a good thing.
but as to futility in the Landrum-Griffin context, if you have an opportunity, or if your clerks have an opportunity to look a little further at our brief, I think you'll see that the case law is quite clear. They must make an effort to exhaust the internal union remedy. And if they don't make that effort, then the district court is entitled by exercise of discretion to determine whether or not to eliminate that requirement.
There is a procedure where it could be heard by a different body or something, isn't there?
Recusal is a fairly common thing in these proceedings. If you look back at the record in this case, you will see that in the original set of charges filed by Mr. Newell and Mr. Vogt,
I know that those went to some other counsel.
They went to the joint counsel level. And that was done because people recused themselves. And at the joint counsel level, people recused themselves, including Mr. Newell, who was not allowed to sit in judgment on charges that involved him. So recusal is quite a common thing. There's a specific procedure in Article 19 of the Teamster Constitution that deals with that. That's also a part of the supplemental appendix attached to Mr. Reardon's affidavit. There's nothing unusual about these procedures. Now, Your Honor, there was a question asked of Mr. Schoenberger regarding why is Mr. Newell not here. Mr. Newell's case, of course, was dismissed completely, and Mr. Newell did not file an appeal to this court. Why he didn't do that, I don't know, but that's why he's not here. He's not simply not a party to this case.
I understand that, but I was interested if the record told us why, and apparently it doesn't.
I don't believe the record tells us why he did not appeal, Your Honor. His case, though, was thrown out, and he never filed any appeal. Your Honor, as to the questions of damages, the court below, Judge Goodstein, I think did an excellent job of handling the damages questions. In our view, the plaintiffs here simply failed to pursue things which they thought belatedly that they should pursue. That's not our fault. It's not this court's fault. You can't wait 3 years after a complaint is filed and then decide for the first time during a final pretrial conference that you're going to seek damages that are special damages under Rule 9G. The court simply doesn't allow that. Or you don't request it, and you don't plead it, you don't get it, and you can't seek it. And there's nothing really unusual about that. As a matter of fact, at page 46 of Mr. Vogt's brief, he says he agrees with that legal conclusion. Finally, I would point out to you on that very issue, as to the allegation that he was somehow emotionally distressed, attached as part of the supplemental appendix, pages 152 and 3, are some excerpts from Mr. Vogt's deposition in which he was asked whether he had any damages of that type, physical, mental, emotional, did he seek treatment of any kind. The answers to all of those questions are no. So I think that was a newly invented claim for purposes of trying to pressure us at the final pretrial conference. Your Honor, there's nothing remarkable about this case. It really doesn't belong here. Unless the court has further questions for us, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Try to be as fast as I can, Judge. Talking about Finnegan and counsel's argument, every other word was election, election, election. Okay? That's not what we're dealing with here. I understand why the Supreme Court reached the conclusion that it did in Finnegan. This was a hotly contested election, and there was a winner in that election. And the Supreme Court rightfully decided that, you know what, the winner of the election ought to have the right to choose staff that supports their agenda and their administration. Why? Because that's what the membership voted for. The membership voted for that administration and that agenda. To not allow that would destroy union democracy. We are simply not dealing with that situation here. This wasn't an election. This is a hostile takeover. My clients tried to rectify wrongs that were occurring within this union, and because of that, adverse actions were taken against them, which included the loss of their appointed employment. I don't believe Congress would say that that's acceptable. I don't believe that. It destroys democracy for the very reasons we've talked about today. It impacts vote and how he'll act in the future. It impacts other officers and how they'll act in the future. And it impacts the membership and how they'll act in the future. As to this exhaustion issue, really what counsel's suggesting is that you can threaten, intimidate, harass to the extent of getting someone to resign, and you're in the clear. And that can't be right. That can't be right. What they're suggesting is threatening, harassing, and intimidating members doesn't violate the law. I don't believe that. It seems to me that the act is quite clear. Let's ensure that unions operate in a democratic fashion, allowing threats, intimidation, and harassment to occur to suppress your own actions as a member does not further democracy. There's a statement by counsel saying that, well, you first brought stuff up at the pretrial conference. Not true. A year before the trial, before any discovery, can I finish my thought? The red light came on.
Go ahead.
Okay, a year before the trial, before any discovery, before Rule 26 disclosures were even exchanged, we sought to amend the complaint to add claims for punitive damages and compensatory damages. So it was not a pretrial issue at first blush. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.